Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Mutual Fund Observer interview with Mitch Rubin, the manager of the River Park Long Short Opportunity Fund. All participants will be in a listen-only mode. Should you need assistance, please signal a conference specialist by pressing the star key followed by zero. After today's presentation, there will be an opportunity for you to ask questions. Please also note that today's event is being recorded. This time, I'd like to turn the conference call over to Mr. David Snowball. You may begin.
Great. Hi, folks. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Snowball, the publisher of the Mutual Fund Observer, and I'm joined tonight with three of the professionals from the River Park Funds, Morty Shaya, the president, Mitch Rubin, lead manager, on River Park's Long Short Opportunities Fund, and Conrad Van Tiehoven, who is his long-term kind of co-manager on this and a number of other products. The genesis for tonight's call was actually last spring, as the folks at the Observer started looking at the bond market, of all things. The conclusion that we had reached was that in the long term, over the last 30 years, there had been no simpler way for an investor to manage volatility than simply to add a slug of bonds to his or her portfolio. That bias continues to show in fund flow statistics now as investors continue charging toward the bond market. Our concern was that going forward, the bond market was in an increasingly wretched state, that its growth couldn't continue, that its valuations were stretched, and that a number of investors were in line for a very, very ugly surprise in not a very long time. And so we began looking for ways in which the average investor or investment advisor might be able to manage volatility without resort to an asset class that could treat them very poorly in the 5 or 10 years ahead. That led us to looking at the long short category, trying to find fund managers who were able to extract value both from the inherent potential of the stock market, but also from its volatility. As we looked at long short funds, we found very, very few that were able to perform at an even vaguely reasonable level. Morningstar had identified no gold-ranked funds, that is, none that they had a great deal of confidence in, although they did point to two or three promising funds, and one of those three was River Park Long Short Opportunities. And so in doing our own research, we identified two small, promising funds with experienced managers that we thought were especially worth your attention. And the folks representing one of those two funds have joined us here tonight. The plan is for me to allow Morty Shaya, the president of the River Park Funds, to make some opening comments, and then we'll transition to Mitch, who will talk a bit about his fund, and then back to a sort of interactive format. So with that, I'd like to thank Morty, Mitch, and Conrad for joining us and turn the air over to Morty.
Thank you, David. Thanks for this opportunity, and thank you for those that are participating on the conference call. So River Park is a relatively new fund family. The executives at River Park are mostly people that have worked together for a very long time at a company called Barron Funds, where we used to work together. I was formerly the president of Barron, and Mitch and Conrad and their team basically were one of the three investment teams at Barron. So we've actually worked together for, I think Mitch and I go back 17 years together, which is quite a long time within this industry. We're very excited about the Long Short Fund, and we're going to, very excited to tell you all about it. Interestingly enough, I know that David and the Observer basically have highlighted two of our other funds where we've actually brought sub-advisors, Wedgwood or short-term high yield, to the marketplace, and these were people that I've identified in the industry that basically I love what they did and I brought them into the mutual fund world. This is a little different because this is homegrown. This is the fund that we've lived and breathed, changed, worked on for the last 17 years until we got to a formula that we really truly believe in, and that's, this mutual fund that we're talking about tonight. In terms of a little bit of history, the fund was actually formerly a hedge fund in a limited partnership structure, and we actually converted the fund from a partnership structure earlier this year into a mutual fund, and And because the strategy is unchanged, it's exactly the same thing that it's doing as a mutual fund as it did as a partnership structure, same amount of leverage, same amount of shorting, and we'll get into all of that a little later, we were able to keep the record, so it's actually a three-year record, even though we just converted it earlier this year. For the benefit of shareholders, the one significant change, or couple of significant changes, well, I'll highlight them, that make this better than it was before as a partnership is, one, the fees are significantly lower. So we went from a 2% fee plus 20% of profits to an all-in expense ratio of 2%. So that's obviously a much cheaper situation for shareholders. So that should be exciting. And we went from liquidity, where investors were able to, they had to commit for a year, and they were able to get out on a quarterly basis, and we went to a very traditional mutual fund structure of daily liquidity. That doesn't mean we want people to go in and out of the fund. We clearly don't want to encourage trading, but if someone gets scared of the market or gets scared of their investment, they want to trade out. They obviously can trade out any day they want. So we're excited about it. Let me just highlight a couple of things about long-short funds, and we'll turn it over to Mitch. So we both go long and short. We tend to go long anywhere from 80 or 90% of our assets to as much as 150%. You know, we're typically a little leveraged, and we tend to be at 110% invested or 125% invested on the long side. And then we'll short securities to lower our market exposure, and we'll short anywhere from 20% to 75 or 80%. So we'll tend to run a balance sheet where we're adding the longs and the shorts together of typically between 100 and 200%. So we've got twice the money potentially working for investors. And we'll probably average over time about 150%, and that's what it's been for the last 3 years. We're about 150% invested if you add both the longs and the shorts. If you just look at the net exposure, meaning the longs minus the shorts, it tends to average about 50%. It could go down to as low as 20 or even less. You know, if we were in a market that we really didn't like, where we saw a lot of opportunities to short stocks and not a lot of opportunities to buy long positions. And on the high side, maybe we'd get to 70% exposed. So on average, think of the fund as 50% exposed. So if we don't add alpha, if we don't really do a great job for investors, we're just doing average, the market goes up, expect that we'll probably participate half as much. The market goes down, we'll also participate half as much. That's sort of the way to look at the net exposure. And then if we're really doing a good job, we should be able to outperform that. And, you know, we have been able to generate good results. Obviously, we can't commit to doing that in the future, but we want to share with you how we think about investing and let you be the judge, you know, before you make an investment. With that, let me turn it over to Mitch. And Mitch, maybe you can give a brief discussion of your background and the team and how we got to this fund, intro to the approach and process, and then turn it back to David for asking some questions.
Great. Thanks, Morty. And thanks again, David, for hosting and for all of you for dialing in. As Morty said and David said, our team has worked together, you know, for the better part of two decades, managing different kinds of long-only, long-short funds, fund managed accounts. And my background, neither Morty or I began our lives thinking we were going to run investment funds. I was an econ major at Michigan. I studied law at Harvard. I practiced law for a little while. Morty was a quant by training and was a physicist. He ran some macroeconomic consulting. And when we found ourselves together at Barron Funds, we really began to develop a way of looking at the world and an approach to investing that has built on itself over the last 17 years of working together, and that we've infused in the people that have worked for us. The most key people came with us when we set up this firm. And the philosophy of investing that we believe in and that has run through all of the different funds we've run over our careers and have culminated in this fund is to try to take the best of everything we've learned and read about investing and apply it in one fund that can give an investor the opportunity to have great returns, to have double-digit returns, to double their money over a 4 to 7 year period, to manage risk and exposure in a thoughtful way, and maybe most importantly, to invest for the long term in very high conviction thoughts. And those thoughts are a combination of things that we've learned from running different funds and watching the world change dramatically over the last 15 or 20 years. And for that, I mean a core of what we did at Barron was great growth stock investing, that if you can find fantastic businesses that have a long-term secular trend, that have a great management team, competitive advantage, barriers to entry, and if you're patient and you buy them at great prices, you can produce dramatic long-term returns. There's two core components to that. It is some secular change that is providing an opportunity to have outsized growth at a company. In a world where GDP grows, you know, low single digits, for businesses to grow 15 or 20 or 25% in earnings, there has to be some significant change and some significant reason for that growth. So it starts with a secular trend, like, you know, a current trend would be the explosion of mobile computing or cloud computing, internet-centric businesses, in financial services, things like globalization of commerce, the electronification of payment systems, maybe domestically the aging of the baby boomer, the natural gas revolution, things where there is a undebatable change that's positively and negatively affecting industries. And that can produce, if you're patient and you apply value orientations to buying growth stocks, you can own the great growth companies of tomorrow at great prices and produce great long-term returns. Another thing, though, that we've learned along the way is that those same changes have just as negative an impact on other businesses that fail to adapt to those changes or lose competitive advantage or are poorly positioned. And these doomed businesses give you a couple of different advantages. One, the market tends not to think companies' earnings go down, so you often have the opportunity to invest against businesses where you have high conviction that in the future the earnings are going down. It gives you a great market hedge. It gives you a great hedge to your longs. And so we very much expect to make money on both sides of the book in our portfolio. It also provides a great hedge to our long book in a way that allows us to have less than full exposure and also invest with conviction when the market's most dislocated by protecting capital. Examples of things on the short side, some of which are a natural hedge to things that were long and some of which are just standalone shorts, things like the sunset of the PC stack, whether it's Intel, Microsoft, Hewlett-Packard, Dell, have been long-term shorts for us as we think about the impact of tablets and smartphones and mobile computing. For-profit education, which is something we used to be a long investor in for years, that we think has lost competitive advantage, has over-earned and under-delivered to its students, and is now in the crosshairs of regulation. Console-based video games, again, something we used to be long that now we think has lost its competitive advantage and we think is at risk. Domestic big box retailers, the corner grocery store, defense contractors, things like this. Now, in some ways, it sounds like we have a macro-driven and a top-down focus, and we really don't. It's that secular umbrella provides the framework and the focus for what we are at Essence, which is long-term research-driven stock pickers. We're fundamental analysts that go out and visit companies, build our own models, try as best we can to ignore Wall Street and ignore short-term trading volumes to really try to predict the future earnings of the company from a combination of historical results, our perception of the quality of the management team, their competitive position in the industry, a rigorous study of their financial model, and building our own models and doing our own research. And we try to combine in doing that the best small cap and large cap stocks we can find. We are market cap agnostic in our research. We, as Morty said, it's our goal is to be invested against the conviction of our research. So if our exposure winds up being higher or lower, it's built by our conviction in the companies we invest in. So we're not forced to be fully invested long only as we were in a lot of our funds over time. We're not mandated to be net short or anything. We go where the opportunity is. And that flexibility to react with an offensive mindset to the volatility in the market is something we think can add a lot of advantage. And we also try to combine the best of value and growth. And so I've always thought it was odd that people identify themselves as a value fund or a growth fund. No growth investor wouldn't want a cheaper stock, and no value investor wouldn't prefer a company that grows a lot. So we want both. We only want to own companies that are growing or on the short side shrinking dramatically, but we only want to own and short them if we think the price gives us the opportunity to double our money. And so by combining all of our experiences in one fund, we think we can try to approach, you know, the highest and best outcome that an investor would want, which is to participate in strong markets, to protect capital in down markets, and to have a contrarian approach to generating very strong returns without the risk of very big drawdowns. And that, you know, that nirvana of what you're seeking in an investment fund is really how this fund is structured around the experiences our team has had together in trying to bring everything we've done into one product. Now, let me pause there, and maybe David or Morty or any of you want to jump in with questions, we can take it from there.
That's great. Do you want me to take it over, Morty?
Yeah, go ahead, David.
Oh, cool. Well, thanks, Mitch. I've spent a lot of time looking at the fund and at the River Park site. For the benefit of the folks who are listening in, I'd suggest that you check the River Park Fund's site out. There are three things that strike me as potentially useful there as kind of adjuncts to our conversation tonight. The Observer profiled Mitch's fund in August, and the kind of reprintable version of that profile is on the River Park homepage. But in addition, the guys pointed out that because this uses the same structure as their previous hedge fund, they're not only able to give you the three-year returns for the hedge fund, they were also kind enough to provide some pretty detailed performance numbers for the fund so that folks who want to look at the fund profile at the River Park site can get a pretty good idea of what the maximum drawdown has looked like historically, how the month-by-month and quarter-by-quarter returns have played out. And then finally, I do find it kind of interesting that Mitch has, if not exactly a hit list, certainly a list of industries which he and Conrad are fairly sure are, you know, if not doomed, at least working their way toward the graveyard. And so for folks who are interested in what would be, I think, the biases of the fund, the sorts of places where you might find the long or short exposure, the most recent manager commentary has a kind of detailed list of those things. So just at the start, I think there's some interesting additional resources for folks who are trying to gather enough information to become kind of comfortable with their decision. Speaking of comfort, I had kind of asked my readers what sort of questions they might have for you. And the overwhelming response that I get, Mitch, is one of skepticism about this whole notion of long-short investing. Folks aren't yet, I think, comfortable with the idea that this is something that's going to have sort of stable long-term advantage. It's not going to sort of produce alpha. I was wondering, at one level, and that's certainly true, if you look at the category returns, the long-short group as a whole is pretty darn embarrassing. You would be better off in a short-term bond fund over most trailing periods than in the average long-short fund. I was wondering if you had a thought about why this style of investing seems to be so, you know, exceedingly difficult to pull off, and then how you've kind of gone about responding to your understanding of the challenge of getting both of these parts right.
Well, I think, you know, it's a good observation, and especially whether it's in the mutual fund format or in the traditional partnership, a lot of the long-short funds and hedge funds have not produced great results in the last few years. They had some spectacular results in sort of the first half of the decade or maybe up until the crisis. Many didn't protect capital as well as they hoped. And I think what's happened over the years, and I think this is out in the regular long-only land too, and I think a lot of investors have lost their way in trying to manage volatility and predict short-term macro events. I mean, I've been in the business 20-odd years now. There's a bunch of great managers that I've grown up in the industry with, and I can't tell you how many of them All they want to talk about is the outcome of the fiscal cliff, what to do with the euro, how China's acceleration or slowdown might hurt, how they want to position for QE2 or QE3. Very few managers that I talk to anymore are trying to figure out what a company is going to earn 4 or 5 years out and has any patience to own it over time. And I think what happens is they wind up being whipsawed in volatile markets. So they increase exposure when the market looks stronger, only to get caught in a drawdown when the market sells off, and then they take exposure off after periods of poor performance, and then they miss periods of up, and they wind up at the end of the year having bought high and sold low. And it, while that, I think, that's a challenge for the retail investor too, and that sense of having a process that is time honored and a approach to investing that's longer term with a higher conviction and a sense of, I think, macro and trading's place in your fund. There are very few macro investors, and there are very few fast traders that produce great long-term returns over time. And so I think, in the long-short world in particular, I think the fact that they have the ability to go anywhere, and a lot of managers have been very reluctant to make a call on the market, have kept them from performing well. The funds do tend to protect capital when the market trades down, and it's that participating in strong markets that I think they've lost their way to. We think about the world very differently. When you think about our fund versus other long-short funds, we tend to be long growth stocks, and we tend to short individual companies. A lot of funds are long kind of deep value stocks, and then they short ETFs for some macro hedge. Many don't use their balance sheet, so you'll find them under 100% invested and under, in low gross. And, you have to take some risk to create returns, and you have to invest with conviction to create returns. And so our theory is that individual stock picking and patient long-term research and having conviction in your names to buy them when your great longs when they're down and they're cheap, and to stay with your shorts if they run on some short-term squeeze. I just think that sense of a patient long-term approach to investing has been a bit lost.
Okay. Now, the reason I think some folks would say that it's been a bit lost is that the correlations between stocks are rising, in part because there are so many ETFs out there, and so it's not possible to buy a stock that isn't being sold as part of a package, in a number of fast trading programs. Do you have reason to believe that that's going to impair your ability to have the single great company still sort of dramatically outperform over the long term? Or do you think there's still a way of disaggregating that from the many indexed and passive packages it gets tied into?
I couldn't be a bigger skeptic on the theory of correlations impacting good stock pickers' ability to add value. And when we think, even just thinking over the three plus year life of this fund, long Apple and Qualcomm, the leaders of the mobile revolution, and short HP and Dell, the leaders of the Wintel PC revolution, or long Visa and MasterCard as great payment companies, and short for-profit education companies who've come under regulatory scrutiny. These have been dramatic moves in stocks. So yes, on any given month, if there's been some big macro event that the market rallies on QE3 or it sells off on some euro thing, all stocks might move in one direction. Mm-hmm. When you broaden the lens over time, stocks react to earnings. I couldn't believe anything. If there's one takeaway from this call, it's that we believe that the primary driver of the value of a company is its ability to generate earnings and cash flow over time. And those companies that grow earnings and cash flow dramatically, if and especially if they're bought at a great price, you're going to make money over time, and you're going to tend not to lose a lot of money. A great business with a great balance sheet generating a lot of cash has so many ways to win, whether it's dividends, stock buybacks, getting acquired. And businesses that are contracting, not because the economy slips from 3% growth to 1% growth, but I mean seriously contracting. Earnings at Nokia went from $2 to negative $2. That is a company that is going to lose dramatic market cap. And so that belief that while the macro and the cyclical tend to dominate the newspapers, the secular trend of earnings dominates the movement of stock prices, we believe very strongly.
Okay. And so if we think about your argument for the fund as being kind of different from its, you know, undistinguished peers, in part you're more aggressive about using leverage. That is, you're more willing to have a conviction and go above 100%, where you think a lot of your peers don't use that flexibility. You focus more on individual names and less on market segments, shorting as a whole, for example, less on kind of short-term macro events. And then you have a kind of difference in time frame. You're thinking more about holding, if it's Apple, for 5 years, all things being equal, rather than trading out of it at the end of the fourth quarter. Is that sort of the
David, this is Morty. Let me try to address a little bit of that. You know, the first part of the point that you were making, I'm not sure that I would agree with.
Mm-hmm.
So I think most hedge funds, long-short hedge funds, actually use substantially more leverage than we do.
Okay.
I would say we're on the moderate leverage side,
mm-hmm.
although we probably have a little bit more leverage than a lot of the mutual fund peers in this liquid alternative space.
Right.
But by and large, 150%, you know, gross exposure is, in the world of long-short hedge funds, I would say very moderate. There's a lot of funds out there that are 200%, 300%, 350%.
Right. Just listen to Mitch talking about just vis-a-vis other mutual funds.
Right. So he was looking at some of the, some of the other funds in the category that really aren't using balance sheet at all. So we're using it a little bit.
Okay.
The other two points that you made are dead on. I mean, we are focusing on fundamentals of businesses, and a lot of other hedge funds, are clearly macro strategic, reacting to, the daily news. And maybe just as importantly, and Mitch mentioned this a little while ago, but I want to mention it again. We believe strongly that there's this almost arbitrage that we're taking advantage of, that we're looking at the long term and analyzing businesses with a time horizon that we think of as measured in years, where a lot of other investors are focusing on today, tomorrow, this week, long term is next quarter. And that arbitrage gives us opportunities to be contrarian. So, the volatility that you talk about, this, the fact that the market is so correlated up and down,
mm-hmm.
really means that on those days when the market is going up, even the companies that we hate the most, the ones that we want to short, are moving up, and that gives us an opportunity to short those companies. And the opposite is also true. When the market goes down in the aggregate on any given day or week, all the great businesses are probably going down as well, and that's what's giving us the opportunity to, again, be contrarian and to buy that long position at what we think is an attractive price. And that's, that's part of the reason why we think volatility helps, us perform over time.
Okay, great. And I suspect that you should have access to a satisfying amount of volatility.
Right.
Why then, out of curiosity, did you change it into a mutual fund? I mean, it does seem like you'd make more money getting 2 and 20 than getting 2.
Go ahead, Mitch.
As we reflected on our approach to investing, which is to try to take the best of everything we've learned, as we thought about growing our business, one of the things we always look for in a growth business that's trying to, that's an interloper and trying to grow and take market share is the ability to either price differently or to have a more client-centric product.
Mm-hmm.
The thought of saying to we think the bet, just like we've taken the best of small cap and large cap investing and look at our long book as just the best companies, and we've taken the best of long and short to say we can invest in the full life cycle of a company when it's small and growing, when it's large and dominating, and when it's lost its way and is on the downside. We similarly think there is some great client-centric structures that we have a lot of experience in growing mutual fund businesses based on our experience at Barron. But there is, tactically, we think a long-short fund is a higher and better approach to investing with given our the way we do research. And so as a young firm that didn't have any products to cannibalize, to us the opportunity to play offense as we're, you know, gathering investors and marketing the fund, I think most long-only investors would be attracted to a fund in a volatile world that has the ability to protect capital in down markets, to use leverage at the bottom, to try to get, you know, get it all right all the time. But all of the people that have gone into hedge funds and been dissatisfied by either the illiquidity, the lack of transparency, the ridiculously high fees, we have an opportunity to market to them that, hey, we have better returns than the average hedge fund. We charge much, much lower fees. We're transparent in that we show you the portfolio on a regular basis. And if you don't like what we're doing, you can leave whenever you want. And by the way, you can own it at any brokerage firm that we're distributed at. It doesn't have to be in some private partnership where you get a statement from time to time. And we don't issue K-1s and things like that. It's a very tax-efficient vehicle. So to us, you know, as a team that wants to grow a business that's now our own, the ability to take the best of both worlds and also offer a great deal to clients in order to grow our business and take market share as a firm. So to us, you know, it's a very healthy fee to just have a management fee. And I would say we are way more competitive than we are greedy. It's a very reasonable fee. We don't need to overcharge to grow the business. And if we wind up with 20% better returns for our investors than our peers because we're not charging that fee, you know, we're going to have a very profitable business and everybody will get a great deal. So it works quite well for us.
There were other firms that have hedge funds would worry about launching a mutual fund because they might cannibalize their own business. Your strategy is to cannibalize them for them, right?
Well, you know, we look at it, you know, we grew up in mutual fund businesses. So daily liquidity and managing in a transparent portfolio, being registered with the SEC, complying with all the rules of the 40 Act, this is second nature to us. But we've also spent quite a bit of time in the hedge fund world. We've run hedge funds for the better part of 6 years. And we truly believe long-short investing and using a balance sheet and the ability to short companies is the highest and best expression of who we are as investors. So again, why not take the best of both worlds? And, you know, if we grow a business and produce great returns, our business will be nicely profitable. But yes, we have no problem cannibalizing other people's businesses.
Cool. Well, especially if they're overcharging, it probably is much like some of the industries you're shorting. It's, you know,
exactly. I'm not sure, especially for a liquid stock pickers strategy, I think those lockups and those performance fees are not, you know, to us it's not appropriate. There's a level of excess fee that didn't feel right to us.
Okay, great. So as folks are thinking about a fund like yours, what is it that they should be looking for? Like, because people have to make sense out of, you know, why would I own this? What am I going to get here in terms of sort of a risk-return profile over the long term? As I'm thinking about this, is this an alternative to, you know, my very conservative blue-chip fund? Or is it, should they think of it in the same box that they might think of a hybrid fund where there would normally be a slug of bonds or something like that to manage volatility? How do folks who haven't traditionally owned long short funds make sense of what to do with them?
You know, to me, as I describe the fund to people who haven't traditionally owned long short funds, I say, you know, the goal of the fund is to take advantage to, so we don't want the excuse of because we're long short, we didn't make you great returns, or we think it's a bond fund. It's very much an equity fund. We seek equity returns, and the goal of the fund is to double our clients' money every 4 to 6 years, double-digit returns. The benefit of having a long short fund is that at points of distress and dislocation, you have the ability to protect capital because your mandate is not to be fully invested all the time. So you always have the problem of a long-only fully invested fund, and believe me, we run them, we still run them here. I think there are some great managers in them. In rising markets, they perform quite well, but they have a very hard time protecting capital, and they tend to get outflows when the market's down. So they're selling stocks when they're going down. They get inflows when the market's up. They're buying stocks when they're going up. And they don't have the benefit of the full cycle of their research, which is when they no longer think a company is interesting or it's lost its way, there's no ability to express that. And so to me, it is very much an equity fund, but it's an equity fund that should have the benefit of managing and protecting capital. You know, if you any of the great investing books of all time say job one is to protect capital. Well, long-only funds cannot protect capital in down markets. They are mostly mandated to be fully invested. And I think there's a more modern view to managing an equity fund for the investor who wants to outsource both capital allocation, risk management. If you've said, hey, I'll manage the risk myself and this, you know, equity fund is my equity exposure, then I would suggest look at our long-only funds. But for an investor who said, you know, for me, having a core fund that can make money in up and down markets and is and regardless of the direction of the market, our goal is to double our clients' money. You're not going to get that in a bond fund, and you're not going to get that in a long-only fund.
David, you know, I wanted to let me add a couple of thoughts there.
Sure, sure.
The you know, when people are thinking about an allocation within their portfolio, and if they're looking for equity-like returns, they're looking at sort of the return side of their analysis. Then,
uh-huh.
Yeah, I think this looks a lot like an equity portfolio. But I think you raise an interesting point, because when other people are looking at their portfolio and saying, "Boy, how should I look at the risk associated with this investment?" then it looks a lot like, you know, a deep value portfolio in the sense of it's, you know, I want to have equity exposure. I'm a little bit afraid. I don't want to jump in with 2 feet, so I want some downside protection. A lot of people look to value funds to give them that protection. This is a different way of doing that. We're buying growth stocks, but you're not fully invested. You're in this hedged portfolio. You know, and a lot of people look at those hybrid funds, you know, as strategies as another way of doing that. Hey, I want some equity exposure. I don't want to go in with both feet, and they turn to those hybrid funds. I think liquid alternatives are today's hybrid funds of yesterday. It's a way for investors to go in and basically say, boy, I want equity exposure, but, you know, I don't want to go in with both feet.
Right, a sort of cowardly equity exposure, which I think for most of us is more sensible. The sort of cowardly line is more likely to survive than someone who is very sure that they want a high volatility product because they think they have a long time frame.
The other thing I would add, David, is, you know, while it hasn't necessarily been available in the markets for the last year or so, buying a busted convert or a busted high yield, using the derivative market when volatility spikes to manage risk, these are all tools that we've had a lot of experience doing. We've been able to add a lot of value, especially on a risk-adjusted basis, by just having other tools that help us always invest the most efficient with the best risk-reward against our research. And the ability to take advantage of the layups the market gives you, whether it's in a very high premium derivative market by selling calls or selling puts, whether it's a broken convert that we can buy with equity-like exposure but higher in the capital structure. It's all predicated on getting the best risk return while managing downside volatility.
Sure. You hadn't mentioned before those sort of non-stock options. Do they take up much of the portfolio? Like if you look over a three-year span and you're talking about busted convertibles,
no, I would not expect stuff like that to be more than, you know, 10% of the fund at any one given point in time.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there are markets where over time, as the market changes and evolves, as I think over my career, you know, even back at Barron, the ability to, you know, there was a point at which we bought Amazon's high-yield bonds at 50 cents on the dollar, yielding 20% coupon, you know, with 100% return to par. And it was just a higher, better risk reward than owning the equity. Now, with where high yield markets are today, with where interest rates are today, we haven't done any of that in this fund, but we've done it in the course of our career. The same thing with derivatives. If there's massive volatility spiking, And the derivative market gives us a lower risk, very high return, very high yield way to manage, either leg into a position, to hedge a position, to hedge a short. That all of those tools are available to us in this fund that aren't available in a traditional fund. So we,
right.
You know, we get to play the game with both hands and both feet untied.
When we think of using derivatives, you know, we typically are thinking about listed options, and our mantra, you know, within the fund is only use derivatives if you have an opportunity to use them to lower risk, to accomplish something by lowering risk. We don't use derivatives to gain leverage. You know, we can, you know, we can leverage the fund because it's a hedge fund. We don't need to use derivatives for that.
Okay, cool. Well, here was my plan at this point, if this made sense, Mitch. I was going to try to warn folks that I was going to turn the air over to our callers. I would ask one last question so that folks had a chance to take a sip of water, get their dander up, do whatever they want to do, and then Jamie will handle checking to see if folks in the audience would like to add to the conversation.
Jamie, do you want to give instructions on how to do that now, and then we'll go into the, David's next question?
Sure. At this time, if you would like to ask a question, you may press star and then one using a touch-tone telephone. We do ask that you please pick up the handset before pressing the keys to ensure good sound quality if you're using a speakerphone. To withdraw your question, you may press star and then two. Again, in order to ask a question, please press star and one.
Great. And so the fund has, if you look at its year-to-date performance, just an overwhelmingly excellent record. You're leaving your competitors far in the dust. Since conversion, though, to a mutual fund, it's been sort of the tale of two quarters. The second quarter, the first in which you were a mutual fund, performance was awfully tepid. In the third quarter, you went back to substantially, I think, by about a 2-to-1 margin, outperforming your peers. I was wondering if you want to say just a few words about how to think about that more recent performance. Is there a factor that just moving out of the hedge fund world and back into the 40 Act world affected performance, where you had a, you know, an outstanding last quarter as a hedge fund, then a so-so quarter, then a great quarter, or is that just the way it's going to run?
Yeah, my observation would be it had absolutely nothing to do with the conversion. The conversion was seamless from the portfolio standpoint. The hedge fund investors merged directly into the mutual fund, and from a portfolio perspective, the first day as a mutual fund and the last day as a hedge fund were the identical portfolio and an ongoing entity. But I do think what you're pointing out is that this fund is very much predicated on being a long-term investor that is not trying to time short-term moves in the market. And it is, you know, not uncommon to think that if we've had, you know, an extraordinarily strong first quarter, which we did, that when the market lost its way a bit in the early part of the second quarter, that, you know, it's not uncommon for us, you know, after substantially outperforming, to be down slightly in line or not quite as much less than the market in any given month or 2 month period. We look at it very much over more over a calendar period and more over a sense of whether the companies are outperforming the stocks and the stocks are outperforming the companies. I mean, it's absolutely our goal to trade around our positions, you know, and to take advantage of that volatility. But we're not overly trying to time every top or time every bottom. And so yes, we were disappointed not to have given us the opportunity to sit out the pull down in the second quarter, although that pull down in the second quarter gave us the opportunity to position ourselves to participate well in the third. We think of the performance, we're happy to be measured daily, weekly, monthly, but we very much grade ourselves on a more of a yearly basis, thinking our long should outperform the S&P, our shorts should go down over time, and that over the life of the fund, our drawdowns over a longer period should be half or less than half the market, but we should keep pace even though we have a short book. And when you look at the fund, whether it's last year when we, you know, our longs were flat and our shorts went down a ton, and so we were able to have strong returns in a flat or down market. And this year, you know, to have very strong returns in a market that's up, so that even though we had half the exposure, we still had much, much higher returns than the market, is something we're very proud of. But yes, on any given month or quarter, managing the volatility is not necessarily our primary goal.
Cool. Why don't we check with Jamie to see if we have questions coming in?
And we do. Our first question comes from Bill Fuller. Please go ahead with your question.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for the call. I used to sit in on the Barron calls, so it's a little bit of a reunion for me. I can't remember which fund Mitch was associated with. I'm thinking it was the tech fund, but anyway, you can answer it if you want to. But my question was, getting a little more at David's point, suppose, Mitch, that your brother-in-law comes to you and he's got his 401k and he says, okay, I've got my stock portion of the 401k. How much should I put in your fund?
Well, my brother-in-law did come with that question, and since he's now my ex-brother-in-law, I can answer honestly without pissing my wife. To answer your first question, I co-ran the Barron Growth Fund with Ron. I ran the tech fund, the Barron Eye Opportunity Fund, and I launched and ran for the first 2 years the Barron Fifth Avenue Growth Fund. So it kind of did a lot of what we did at Barron. I actually started off running the REIT portion of the Growth and Income Fund, if you go all the way back to when I started. To me, and, you know, I'm not a wealth manager, so a lot of the theories of asset allocation aren't what I focus on. My biggest allocation of my money is in the long-short fund, and what I tell my friends is if you want to buy one of our funds, buy the long-short fund, principally because it combines everything I think we do well. That doesn't mean, you know, if you think the market's going to be strong, it's possible that our long-only funds will outperform because they're not hedged. If you think the market's going to be weak, it's, you know, the long-short fund should absolutely outperform our long-only funds. Over time, the goal of the fund, I think, is the right goal for the bigger portion of your portfolio, which is, you know, it's a core holding, investing based on long-term secular research. We expect our longs to go up and our shorts to go down. And if we do that well over time, the fund should outperform everything. And that, you know, we're not hiding behind long-short as a reason to underperform, but we do believe it gives us an opportunity to both protect capital in down markets, but maybe most more importantly, to play offense when things are absolutely dislocated. And so, you know, for me, it's the largest portion of my allocation. I think it is for Morty as well. And my, you know, I love all my children, but I like this one the best.
Okay. So can you elaborate just briefly on when the market is really dislocated? I mean, what's that look like to you?
Well, you know, generally speaking, over the last, you know, I would say 4 or 5 years, most of the market dislocation has been some macro event. It's a concern over the debt crisis. It's a concern over the euro. It's a concern over China. It's a reaction to, you know, a nuclear, you know, power plant getting run over by a tsunami. To us, the great secular growth companies grow through macro dislocations because they're not, you know, whether Apple sells iPhones in, you know, drachma or euros, they're going to deposit them in Cupertino in dollars. And so the trends that drive the success of our companies really have almost nothing to do with global GDP. A slowdown in global GDP may slow their growth, but it doesn't hurt their competitive advantage. On the other hand, when GDP slows and companies have to make tough decisions is when those secularly challenged companies tend to have an acceleration of their demise. And because we have a value orientation on the growth side, the way we hope and expect our portfolios to react to relatively quick sell-offs in the market is that our longs hold up and our shorts get killed. And therefore, we have the ability to then cover our shorts when they trade down to super cheap prices, but use that protection from you know, being down less than the market to take advantage, you know, of a great growth stock that's sold off with the market that now sells at an incredibly cheap price. So where our goal, we almost universally challenge ourselves, when the market is red, we should be buying. When the market is green, we should be trimming and raising our shorts. We always want to be contrarian. We always want to play offense.
One more question is, you mentioned natural gas. What are you, I'm kind of intrigued too. I mean, what are you doing there, if anything?
So we're incredibly bullish from a U.S. perspective on the ability for the country to transform itself into being energy independent with a cleaner burning fuel. Now, lots of things have to happen for that to be scaled, but the application of technology to E&P to allow for the more efficient production of resource is something we've been invested in for a long, long time. One of the great winners of our career going back to our Barron days was a company called Cross Timbers that became XTO that was then sold to Exxon. Literally, we made from $400 million in market cap when we first invested to $40 billion when it was sold. Replicating that either by great technology services companies that aren't as levered to the commodity, so we own Schlumberger and National Oil Well Varco, they're global, not necessarily natural gas focused, but increasingly difficult drilling, whether it's shale, deep water, is their expertise. And they run great balance sheets, you know, terrific management teams. In natural gas itself, we've tried to take advantage of this latest sell-off. It's a trick we, you know, a thesis we learned from being with the XTO management team all those years, is when the price of resource drops more dramatically in the stock market than it does in the world, you buy the stocks. And so the best managed E&P companies that own natural gas acreage unlevered to us, which are Southwest, Devon, and Cabot, are all kind of small positions that we think of as our way to buy unbelievably cheap, unbelievably cheaply the best, most efficient producers of natural gas that own their acreage at incredibly cheap prices. So even at $3 gas, these companies make money. They're unlevered. No financial shenanigans like some of the bigger companies, and we're patient. They're not big positions. It's combined about 7 or 8% of the fund. You know, they haven't. We've made a little bit of money. They've underperformed the fund as a whole. When we have the opportunity to buy them at a massive discount to NAV, we add a little bit. But I do think it's going to take a very long time and a lot of political process for it to work, and we're very patient. So we're small there, but we're excited about it. We've done a ton of research on the engine companies, Westport and Cummins, and we've gone out and visited the guys building all the natural gas filling stations. We've actually been short solar, although we're not there, and only there small now. We're very patient. Things that are on the cutting edge, we try to wait till they're underwritable and investable, and most of that stuff today doesn't give us a lot of conviction, so we're just doing our research.
Great.
Thank you.
Down to about 5 minutes. I thought we would check with Jamie to see if we had other callers in.
We do. We have an additional question from Jeff Mayer. Please go ahead with your question.
Yes. I ran into Mitch also in his Barron days, and like probably many of his investees, we were kind of blown away by how deep dive the research and the due diligence was on us as a long investee of the fund. The question is, you know, we were obviously very excited to have all the attention and spent tons of time answering questions and helping you understand the company. How does that process work when you're shorting a company where the company may not be nearly as cooperative or helpful in trying to provide you information for you to come up with your conclusions?
Yeah, that's a great question. On the one hand, I would say a lot of our shorts, especially our bigger shorts, are things we were long for years and years and years, and our understanding of the business is deep enough that a direct, you know, daily line of communication like some of our smaller longs isn't as critical to our investment process. In a lot of ways, I think the experience of having done this for a long, long time, we put the contact with management in a context, which is it is really important to us to have a sense of how the managers are running the business. We get a lot of that from meeting with them face-to-face. We get a lot of that from going everywhere they present in public and asking questions and attending conferences and being willing to get out on the road. And they don't necessarily know who you are and whether you're long or short. We also get a lot of, being voracious consumers of K's and Q's. We've realized that's actually a better place to focus your short research than actually talking to the companies. And field research is even better. So talking to the customers and competitors of the businesses we're short is in many times better than talking to the management team, because they tell you exactly why the company is losing share, where it's gone wrong, where they're pricing them out of the market. But in most cases, they're businesses we've known for a long, long time. It's very rare for us to short something that we haven't worked on for years. And on the other hand, the best management teams that we've known over time, their companies are now struggling, we have no problem telling them we're short, and they invite us to come and tell them why, so that they can think about how to fix it. And it's actually been one of the biggest surprises of running a long short fund is, we're very public about the stuff we own and are short, and I've had more than a handful, it's amazing to me how many CEOs have said, hey, when you're out here, I'd love to sit down and grab a coffee with you and figure out why you're short my stock. So it hasn't been a hindrance to us at all, but we gave it a lot of thought before we were willing to publish our short book, but we realize it's not something that troubles us.
Great. Thank you.
And we're getting a little short on time. Is there room for a final question, Jamie, or are we done?
We do have one additional question, and this comes from Richard Falk. Please go ahead with your question.
I'll try to be brief. Three quick questions. Expected standard deviation of the fund. Second of all, if you go to the maximum short of the portfolio, will that have an impact on the expense ratio? And then I noticed in your long-term views under the long and short, there's nothing related to either agriculture or medical, healthcare type of thing. Any comments on those? Thanks.
Yeah, well, I'll take the ag and the medical, and maybe Morty, you can address some of the statistical stuff. There actually is. We may not have published it in some of the materials. Monsanto is one of our most important longs. It's a top 10 holding. We believe feeding the world is one of the great long-term secular trends of globalization, big swaths of the population moving towards middle class. We've had other investments in. We've looked at all the equipment and machinery companies. We've looked at all the fertilizer companies. We really don't love cyclical and highly capital-intensive businesses. And so rather than dilute by sort of diversifying into businesses that aren't as growthy, Monsanto is a core holding, and we're constantly looking for others. In medical, we have a very we've owned some super high-growth, innovative medical device companies, Intuitive Surgical, we've owned for a long, long time. We still own it. We think it's incredibly interesting. We're constantly in search of medical cost management companies. We had a big position in Amerigroup that got bought out. We have had smaller positions in some other services companies. We generally believe that highly regulated industries are to be tread on very, very lightly. So given Obamacare and all the disruption in payments and medical, we're very cautious about medical. We actually have some stuff on the short side, both in the portfolio. We've been short the pharma companies for a while. We're very intrigued by the medical, the impacts of the aging baby boomer, but we're very worried about the fact that this country is massively overspent on healthcare and the government's short on money. So it's a small part of the fund at this point. Morty, you want to address the...
Sure. So in terms of the risk measures, the fund's been running a standard deviation of about 13%, and figure 70, 75%, 80% of the S&P 500 standard deviation, it probably makes sense. We're running about half the exposure, but at the same time, we tend to be long growth stocks and not value stocks, which adds to the volatility. So figure, 70, 80%, is sort of a good target number relative to the S&P 500. In terms of maximum drawdown, we've been running about half the market, which feels comfortable to us. So think of us as, draw down about half the market, which, you know, I think we're comfortable with. And in terms of the expense ratio, you know, maximum short position for us, you know, is really about 100%. And so think about a dividend yield on the short book of whatever, 150, 200%. And therefore, you know, you could see an increase of 70 basis points, 80 basis points, you know, in that kind of an extreme situation as we sort of increase our short dividend. And yes, it's included in the expense ratio and the gross expense ratio. But frankly, as I look at the expense ratio, I tend to not include those investment-related expenses like margin interest and short dividends. I think of that as an investment expense almost in the same way as commissions we pay when we buy and sell our stock. So I look at both the gross expense ratio, but I also look at the net expense ratio, which would be 2%.
Great. Thank you.
Cool. Jamie, have we run out?
Yes, sir. I'm showing no further questions.
That's great. Then what I'd like to do is to thank Mitch, Morty, and the very quiet Conrad for spending the hour with us. Tape this call will be made available to investors probably within the next couple days, both at River Park's website, riverparkfunds.com, and then at the Observer as part of my December essay, and we'll do a short follow-up story on it there. I'd like to thank the folks who did call in. I hope you found it a good experience. The Observer will try again next month with the second of the two reasonable long-short funds that we were able to identify this summer, Aston River Road Long Short. And so, again, thanks to you all for your time, your patience, and your very fine questions. We're looking forward to hearing from you. Take great care now. Bye.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, we thank you for attending today's conference call. It has now concluded. You may now disconnect your telephone lines.